Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Janae Cummings.
And I'm Kelly Worley. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, August 17, 2016.
By and large, what we've been dealing with here since the weekend, it's been the extreme amount of rainfall that's kind of got everything going.
Recent weather has caused lots of problems for Bloomington's sewer system. More on that later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, new car dangers on a new edition of our consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
Indiana University has begun installing light fixtures along the pathways in Dunn's Woods, according to an article in the Herald Times. The installation process began after students complained of safety concerns in the wooded area, especially during the night. Dunn Woods was the site of a reported assault last November, as well as other incidents in years past. A lack of light fixtures made it difficult for students to see other people in the area. The Herald Times says the 10-acre plot was left untouched for years due to feelings of nostalgia and sentimentality, but student safety is now overriding those concerns. The new LED lights will increase visibility for students walking through Dunn Woods after dark, but will be dimmed down when the Kirkwood Observatory is in use.
A group of local Democrats have founded a new organization called the Richland Bean Blossom Organization to build a presence in the western part of Monroe County. The organization will offer services such as registering voters, recruiting political candidates, and organizing Democratic representation at the Monroe County Fall Festival and Steinsville Quarry Festival. The group will hold a Labor Day picnic on Sunday, September 4th from 1 to 4 p.m. to celebrate their inauguration. The picnic is free and open to the public. They have scheduled meetings on Tuesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Ellisville branch of the Monroe County Library.
The Monroe County Plan Commission is looking for an updated approach to its Unified Development Code as the county continues to grow. In their August 16th meeting, the Plan Commission heard a report from urban design firm MKSK and consultant Graydon Land Use outlining how the county might streamline that code. Chairperson Richard Martin clarifies the area of most concern.
I would caution everybody that what we're talking about tonight is an area around the city of Bloomington, much of which was our old two-mile fringe, but there are parts of it that go beyond that. It also includes some areas that are essentially surrounded by the city of Bloomington.
Urban planner Justin Goodwin of MKSK reviewed the goals of the existing urbanizing area plan.
Those include preserving and protecting the environment, the natural character of the area, protecting vulnerable lands, improving the quality of life for people that live in the urbanizing area, also supporting economic development activity, employment opportunities within the area.
According to the urbanizing area plan, community members would also like the county to preserve green space and connect it where possible to residential developments. Retaining historic character was also deemed important. Goodwin says his group's initial analysis showed current zoning requirements don't support those goals.
Some of the things that we've heard from stakeholders that we've engaged and members of the public that deal with zoning and development issues in the urbanizing area is time and time again we've heard the zoning process as it exists today is rather cumbersome for somebody moving through the development review process. The code itself can be unpredictable. Many recognize it as being fairly outdated. There's quite a reliance on planned unit development, negotiated zoning, which adds to a level of unpredictability.
In addition, Goodwin said he sees changes in the county's demographics, the residential market, and the economic development market.
The need to accommodate lots of different types of uses that maybe weren't anticipated when the existing zoning code was developed years ago. The need to accommodate many different types of uses, maybe in one type of employment facility. Things as simple as that the code can actually be an impediment to economic development goals.
There are currently more than 40 existing zoning districts. Goodwin suggests a first step in streamlining would be to reduce the number of districts and arrange them according to use. The consultants conceived of 13 zoning districts they say more closely fit the intent of the urbanizing area plan. They then grouped the districts into four general categories: employment districts, gateway districts, neighborhood districts, and specialized districts dedicated to green space or civic uses. Goodwin identified the proposed employment districts.
There are a series of employment districts that are generally oriented in the west side and the airport area and potential growth areas to the south of Bloomington along State Route 37 that are already an emphasis for employment and economic development activity today and could accommodate more of the same in the future.
Goodwin suggested denser housing developments be located in or near these employment zones, allowing residents close proximity to jobs. Goodwin recommends any new residential development include a public open space that serves the neighborhood. Regarding manufacturing, Goodwin says that market is changing, making it difficult for any planning code to anticipate specific land use and impacts.
While the use may be appropriate in a wide variety of areas, the combination of intensity and built form help to drive decisions about where that particular type of use and building are appropriate.
Ultimately, the report could be adopted as a policy statement within Monroe County's comprehensive plan and be part of the urbanizing area plan. Martin and Goodwin said a final draft will eventually be available for public review and comment. Planning Director Larry Wilson emphasized the report is a guideline and says there's a lot of detail work yet to be done to develop new regulations.
The Richland Bean Blossom School Board is keeping an eye on safety with new privacy screening measures and a plan to purchase radios to enhance communication. In its meeting August 15th, the school board accepted a $1,000 donation from the Ellettsville First Assembly of God for tinting the office windows at Edgewood Intermediate School. Here's Superintendent Mike Wilcox.
Privacy screen was a new term to me, and all but what it is a great idea that we've been looking at moving towards. It's in our front doors. Basically, our people in the office can see out, but you cannot see in. So, to be blunt, it would slow down an intruder. And also, if any of our secretaries or even building administrators saw that there was someone that did not need into the building, they could see them, but the intruder or someone that has harm intent could not see in as well. So we've talked about moving towards that, and again, this helps it be more cost effective.
Administrators say the school currently uses the same type of screening between its cafeteria and gym. The board also approved advertising for bids for handheld radios to be used by administrators, maintenance workers, and school bus drivers. Wilcox said communication has been a challenge, especially between Edgewood Intermediate and primary schools.
We have encumbered money from last year's budget already. That is $50,000 to at least be a start on this. So, but this would be corporation-wide, and it would completely update all of our communications to where we have good, effective, safe, and secure communication between all buildings in the corporation.
The schools have been using high-grade walkie-talkies, some of which were borrowed from the police department, according to board member Jimmy Durnell. Wilcox said the current equipment has been deemed outdated and ineffective. Board member Randall Wright asked that the board try to secure a discount for trading in the older equipment. In other business, Wilcox told the school board he's optimistic about 2017 enrollment numbers and state funding. The school corporation receives $5,300 in state funding per student. Given the possibility the school corporation could lose some students to the area's new charter school, Seven Oaks Classical School, Wilcox said his estimate of state revenue for 2017 was a cautious one.
Even if we did lose a few students, we are going through there. We are still a positive $172,797 ahead of where we were last year.
Wilcox said an early headcount shows 2,750 students currently enrolled for the 2016-2017 school year. The school corporation enrolled 2,780 students in 2015.
The newly formed Monroe County Public Safety Commission met on August 8th and August 10th to decide how to allocate money collected from the recently approved public safety income tax. The public safety tax is estimated to bring in nearly $7 million in new revenue. Monroe County's Emergency Dispatch Center will receive 30% of those monies off the top. The commission is recommending allocating approximately $390,000 of the remaining funds to fire departments and emergency medical services in the county's townships. Commission member Dorothy Granger noted that amount is only 29% of the amount requested by the townships. City Attorney Philippa Guthrie told the commission the tax will have to be readopted because the state's interpretation of the law differs from the county's.
We did get a letter from the DLGF and the Department of Revenue saying that they did not think our tax was going to carry through January. So you will have to repass. So the lawyers have a meeting Friday to discuss the process again. And it's essentially the same. It's each body has to pass it, each fiscal body. You can do it separately as you did the first time. You can also do it as in one meeting. And that's up to you all.
The members of the Monroe County Income Tax Council will have to readopt the tax before October 31st in order to continue collecting it after December 31st. The council is made up of representatives from the Bloomington City Council, the Monroe County Council, and the Ellettsville Town Council.
Ivy Tech Community College's Bloomington campus led a group of 12 other community colleges and 72 medical device industry partners nationwide to develop the first skill set standards for entry-level jobs in the country. The guide lists potential entry-level jobs and the skills required to work in them. According to Dr. Sing-Yong Lee, chair of the biotechnology program at Ivy Tech and medical device hub leader for the project, the standard took more than 2.5 years to develop and is the first set ever created for the medical field. Lee says this is because the industry has a wide variety of potential jobs and is constantly changing as the new technology develops.
We have to look at all those jobs and combine all those knowledge and skill sets and identify the most important fundamental skills. And then once we identify the jobs, and what are the really core skills that are important? So we have to revise all those skills several times.
Lee says the curriculum at a community college is heavily influenced by the needs of the local workforce, and he says taking into account what employers are expecting for an entry-level position allows for more precise teaching. According to Lee, the process required input from companies like Cook Medical and colleges like Ivy Tech in order to be effective.
Somebody has to figure out what entry-level jobs are available at these medical device manufacturing companies and try to understand what kind of job functions have been performed. So if you're an educator working at community college, if you're going to develop your education program, you have to decide what kind of courses you need to develop so you can teach the right knowledge and skill set for the jobs that are available. In order for you to do that, you need to work with your industry partners who can tell you what entry-level jobs are available. Not only they can tell you the job title, they can also tell you what knowledge and skill sets are required by those jobs.
Ivy Tech and its partners on this project plan to use this skill set for the development of their biotechnology curriculum in the coming years. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Janae Cummings.
And I'm Kelly Worley. Today, Bloomington saw its first extended period without rain in nearly a week. The heavy precipitation during the past several days has caused several issues around town, including with the city's sewer system. The Bloomington Utilities Department reported several cases of sewage overflowing into the streets this week. To find out why that's happening and what the city is doing about the problem, WFHB News Director Joe Crawford spoke today with John Callahan from the Utilities Department.
As you well know, there have been quite a few notices regarding sanitary sewer overflows over the past few days, and I just want to let folks know what that means when they hear that there's been a sanitary sewer overflow in their neighborhood, and can you tell us why that's happened so much lately?
First of all, I can give you the total since Sunday. We had 5 on Sunday, 1 on Monday. We had 4 on Tuesday, and I received notice today of another one occurring, so that makes it, 11 that we have had since this past Sunday. So essentially what's going on is we have had an extreme amount of rainfall over the course of the past few days. Going back to Saturday and Sunday, we received about 2.5 inches of rain during that period, so that kind of got everything rolling. And then, of course, we've had some rainfall since then. Now, a sanitary sewer overflow, that is a discharge or diversion of untreated or partially treated wastewater from a sanitary sewer system. Say you've got a pipe that maybe has like a crack in it, something like that. Okay, so when you're getting rain, you're getting infiltration that is combining with that sewer water. So it's rolling through a sanitary sewer line, because you've got the combined groundwater with the wastewater, and it's going up through the top of a manhole. I mean, the pressure will build up enough that it will climb up that manhole, and in some cases, it just pops that lid off. And there's several causes for that. You can have high level of infiltration of groundwater combined with inflow from storm drains. You can have an undersized system. You can have pipe failures, root intrusion in a sanitary sewer line, fat oil and grease blockages. That's something that can cause them. But by and large, what we've been dealing with here since the weekend, it's been the extreme amount of rainfall that's kind of got everything going.
So how does the utilities department actually know when a sewer overflow has occurred?
Again, if you see water coming out of the top of a manhole. See, we'll get calls from people, and they'll say, hey, you know, I see water coming out of this. Can you send somebody over there to check that out? And so what they do, someone goes over there, and if they determine that it is a confirmed SSO, we just go ahead and let that SSO run its course, because you really can't start cleaning it up while it's still flowing, okay? So you got to wait till it stops, and then if there is any debris that is observed after it stops, then we clean that up.
And this part of Indiana is certainly not, you know, we're no stranger to heavy amounts of rainfall. There have been 11 overflows in the past few days. Is that unusually high? Is that an unusually high number?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I know last year we had, I want to say we had a total of 26. So, yeah, this probably having 11 over this period of time probably isn't, I wouldn't say normal. It's probably something that, yeah, we would normally see. The other thing, too, I'd like to point out to everybody is it's not just here in Bloomington, Indiana. I mean, the SSOs happen everywhere, no matter, you know, communities, towns, cities, wherever you have a sanitary sewer system, SSOs can happen.
So they can happen, I assume, and I understand that the utilities department surely doesn't want them to happen, as well as I would imagine most residents don't want there to be untreated sewage released in their neighborhoods. So what's the utilities department doing about this issue?
Okay. We have an ongoing, what would I guess be, lack of better words, proactive maintenance program. We have crews who regularly go out and they televise the sanitary sewer system. And what they do is they run a camera through the sanitary sewer lines. And what they're looking for is cracks, evidence of roots coming in there, that sort of thing. Anything that could block the flow of the wastewater. Now, something that we do when we find problems, say if you got roots, well, we have what's called a root cutter. And we run that through the line, and it'll trim off the roots. We also have a program, it's called cured-in-place pipe. It is a process where they'll open up like a sewer manhole, and they run this stuff down into the manhole, and what it does, it cooks in the sanitary sewer line. We do this in areas where we see cracks in the system, or we might send that down in an area that has been identified as being a very aged section of pipe. Essentially what we're doing is we're insulating the inside of the pipe where you have like maybe a crack and be able to cover that up. And one other thing I would add is the reason that, you know, we have started sending out these notices for the SSO overflows. This is part of Mayor John Hambleton's initiative to operate city government with full transparency. And so confirmed SSOs has joined the list of public advisories that we issue. So, you know, whenever we have one, whenever one has been confirmed, we will send that out to the public.
All right, John. Well, hey, thanks so much for talking with us today.
No problem.
That was Bloomington Utilities Department Public Affairs Specialist John Callahan speaking with WFHB News Director Joe Crawford. More rain is forecast for tomorrow in Bloomington.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Have you got a new car? Congratulations, mostly. New cars tend to be safer, cleaner, well, unless you have a diesel that's been cheating on its emissions tests, and better at getting good mileage. But new cars, whether you own them, lease them, or rent them, have some dangers that cars have never had before. That's because modern cars are controlled by computers, and the computers are connected to the internet all the time, whether you like it or not. When you get into a new car, you give up your privacy. It's not just features like OnStar, which always knows exactly where you are, and since 2009, allows the car company to remotely slow and stop the car. This can foil a car thief or end a police chase, but whatever the company can do, hackers can do too. Last year, Charlie Miller and Chris Velasic, two security experts, showed they could remotely hack into a 2014 Jeep and stop it cold. Chrysler had to recall 1.4 million cars to fix the software. This year, they plugged a laptop in directly and could make the car accelerate wildly, turn the steering wheel, and slam on the brakes at high speeds. Scary. Beyond that, most new cars have about 100 so-called actuators, which sense everything that goes on with the steering, engine, transmission, and brakes. They also sense weight in the seats, whether the seat belts are fastened, how fast the car is going, and a lot more. And they report this information to the manufacturer. And since 2014, all cars sold in the U.S. have a black box event recorder, which stores all this data for use by the cops if the car is involved in an accident or a crime. And now the insurance companies have gotten into the act. Progressive, Allstate, Nationwide, State Farm, and others routinely monitor where you go and how you drive, and may be selling their data to marketers. Cars with voice-activated controls are even listening to what you say in your car, all the time. Finally, two guys in Houston were recently busted for using a laptop to steal over 100 new cars. They reprogrammed the keyless entry system, got in, and drove away. What can you do about it? Well, not much at present. Most of these systems are impossible to disconnect. Some car makers are reportedly putting in an off switch, but they aren't telling their dealers or service techs about it, much less drivers. And most people don't understand these new features, so there hasn't been any big demand for privacy yet. So if you have or get a new car, talk to your dealer about all this. Find out what your options are, and tell them what you don't like in no uncertain terms. Me? I drive a car that's over 20 years old. The cost of keeping it running is less than the payments on a new one. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News in WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Taylor Haggerty, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Joe Crawford.
Our engineers today are Heather Perry and Rob Schoon. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Kelly Worley.
And I'm Janae Cummings. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. Recognized among the best newscasts in 2015 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.